Welcome back, podcast friends, to I Am Healthy and Fit. I Am Healthy and Fit is the affirmation that begins changing your health and fitness from the inside out. I'm Steve Jordan, your health and fitness coach. Welcome, Keith, to the I Am Healthy and Fit podcast. Keith Campbell is a PhD in the science of narcissism, and he has written a book called The New Science of Narcissism, Understanding One of the Greatest Psychological Challenges of Our Time and What You Can Do About It. Welcome, Keith, to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
Yeah, this is an interesting topic, Keith. And when I first was approached to do this conversation and have this podcast interview with you, the word narcissism, you know, jumps out at me. One, because I believe that I am a recovering narcissist, always dabbling in the space of being in it and out of it. I'd like to say now more than ever, I'm out of it. But it is a in a world today of technology and science and selfies and, having to self-promote and especially in the health and fitness space, I feel like it's an ever growing and challenge for people to manage this. Really, it's a disease, if you will. I mean, I haven't read your book yet, but I would label it as a disease. And when I say disease, dis-ease, right? A place where we are not at ease with ourselves, a place where we're uncomfortable, where we are insecure, but we think we really have it all together. So love to hear some of your, initial inputs on the word narcissism, its definition, how it is defined today, and how you got here to, focus your attention on writing a prolific book like this.
Well, it's going to be fun to talk about some of this fitness stuff because there's so much research on narcissism and celebrity and social media. And anyway, there's a lot to unpack.
Let's unpack it.
Yeah, it'd be interesting. But first, I think it's important to kind of define narcissism because the term a lot of people throw around, often they use it as a pejorative. Like no one wants to say like, I'm a narcissist. I mean, it's not something most people like. But when we talk about it in the scientific literature, in the psychological and personality research, we're talking about some specific things. So first of all, we're talking about narcissism is a trait, and that means that some people have a lot of it, some have a little of it, most of us are in the middle. And there's two forms of that trait of narcissism. The form that most of us think about and the form that you see in the selfies and with the abs and with more self-promotion is what we call grandiose narcissism. So this is this combination of sort of a sense of entitlement, but also feeling you're attractive, You like to seek attention, you like to express yourself, you like to be admired, but also people who are grandiose are driven, charismatic, charming, likable, extroverted. So it's this interesting combination of traits. An example of like Iron Man and the, Tony Stark is kind of that classic combination of grandiosity where there's some real negative stuff, some antagonism to people, some hostility, self-centeredness, but charm, charisma, likability, success. So that's the kind of narcissism you see in politicians and CEOs and bad ex relationships and everything else. There's this other form, which is called vulnerable narcissism, where you see this self-centeredness, but also insecurity and low self-esteem. So people they might fantasize about being successful, but they're, living at home. Maybe they're not out there seeking challenges, but they're fantasizing about it. Their self-esteem goes up and down, and it's associated with depression and insecurity and anxiety. And so these two forms of narcissism, grandiose and vulnerable, the grandiose you see out in the world and the vulnerable you see in therapy a little more because of the anxiety and insecurity. And interesting, you get people who are both. You get people who start as vulnerable and they kind of build themselves up and become more grandiose. You find people that kind of vacillate between the two so that they can both work together. And then in addition to those traits, there's a clinical disorder called narcissistic personality disorder. And this is an extreme form of narcissism you know, really with some grandiosity and also some vulnerability, it becomes extreme and it damages your life. It messes up your work. It messes up your marriage. It messes up your family. It's a problem with narcissism that becomes extreme and inflexible. So if you can be narcissistic on camera, and you're in Hollywood, so you're LA, you know this. Yeah. You can be narcissistic on camera and turn it off, great. But if you're narcissistic on camera and you can't turn it off, you're gonna have trouble forming relationships with people. Mm. You know, you might still be very successful, but you're not gonna have loving, caring, intimate relationships. And if your success falls apart, you can't really connect with people, it might become a disorder, might become a problem. So this disorder is relatively rare. We're talking 1 or 2%. Mm-hmm. So most of them, we're talking about narcissism, we're talking about just individual differences.
Mm-hmm. Now, in all of that, you know, definitely makes sense. What I find interesting about narcissism and the science study of it is it's not like a sitting duck. It doesn't stand still. It's consistently moving and, you know, changing and morphing. And I wouldn't be surprised if it's changed. You know, I'm sure, I mean, you have a PhD, so you've been studying this for a long time. And I would imagine that over the past 5 to 10 years, it's changed and morphed into something bigger and more bold, if you will, for lack of better words.
Yeah, no, absolutely. You know, you do science and the stuff is always evolving. And narcissism is a very interesting trait historically, because it comes out of this sort of psychodynamic tradition, this Freudian tradition. And in the Freudian idea about personality was that what you see on the outside was often the reverse image of what was on the inside. Mm. So, you know, somebody was out there saying, you know, I'm so straight, I only like women, no way I'm gay. Deep down might have homosexual fantasies. Somebody out there who's saying, I'm awesome, I'm the best ever, everyone look at me, might deep down inside be insecure. They might really not like themselves. And so this idea took form that people who are really grandiose, who are exhibitionistic and self, you know, attention seeking, are deep down sort of insecure. It doesn't really seem to be the case, but that idea was around for about, you know, 80, well, it's still around, but 100 years. Took a long time, but we've managed to realize that these things can be really separated, that there are people who are just straight up through and through, really confident, really dominant. They're not insecure at all. They don't, you know, they're just kind of these alpha personalities. Mm. And there are other people that are insecure, but they're also trying to do their best and they waffle in between the two. And there are other people that are, you know, that want to be successful, but they're too scared to do anything, so they fantasize about it a lot. Mm. So all this sort of range of personalities out there, which back in the day would have all been considered some version of narcissism.
So is there a formal test or like a personality test that will showcase this or these different traits?
Yeah, we've got, there's a bunch of them that have been developed over the years. We put up a website, narcissismlab.com, that has a couple of them up, but you can just Google, you know, narcissism questionnaires. The classic ones that some are grandiose, measures of grandiose narcissism, the classic is called the Narcissistic Personality Inventory, and we've been measuring that since the late 70s, early 80s. And for vulnerable narcissism, the classic scale was called the hypersensitive narcissism scale. Mm-hmm. And that's been around since the 80s. And all these have been improved and modified. But if you just Google them, and you can just go with personality, it's not that complicated. If you mm-hmm. do a measure right, you can go online, Google a measure, and read the items and look and see if it fits you or not.
Mm. Now, if you do this test and you are considered in a, I'm sure there's a level of narcissism that you can fall into a range. Should you be concerned? And if you do fall into a higher range, should you seek help or counseling or therapy? What should you do?
Oh, I don't think you should seek help or counseling or therapy unless, you know, you're suffering or causing other people to suffer. But, you know, if you're in a very high range, like if you took the Narcissistic Personality Inventory, which is, we've got a lot of norm data on it, and you're scoring at the, you know, couple standard deviations in the top, you know, 2 or 3% of people, I think, well, that's interesting. What is it about me? How is that helping me? How is that harming me? If I have a very elevated personality, what is that doing to me? Mm. I mean, lots of us have elevated personality features. Some of us, yeah, I'm very extroverted. I'm very open. It causes me problems. It helps me in some ways. It hurts me in some ways. So I usually just ask people to, no, I don't ask people to do anything. I would reflect, you know, just how is this working for me? When I look at personality, when I look at narcissism and all personality, it's a trade-off. I mean, there's good things about it and bad things about it. And for every narcissistic person out there, there's somebody saying, God, I wish I were more narcissistic. Maybe not that much, but a little more would be nice. And there's somebody who's so narcissistic and saying, God, this is damaging my relationships. I want to dial it back so I can have more love in my life and more affection, more connection with people, more authenticity, you know? So the people are always trying to move their personality one way or the other.
Mm-hmm. I think it's interesting because, I mean, what I do with, you know, I'm in the health and fitness space and I've been in this game for a long time. You know, I used to just train bodies. But today more than ever, and this is the premise of this podcast, if you've never listened to before, I'm healthy and fit as an incantation or an affirmation to believe that you are healthy and fit before you even lift a dumbbell or do an exercise. You've got to believe it before you can achieve it. And I believe that holds true in any area of your life that you want success in. And in my experiences, I've dialed down what has been the difference between those that have been successful and those that haven't. And the biggest reason is that person's why. Why do they want to be successful? What is their purpose? And when you can believe it, believe that I am healthy and fit before you even do it, like it's like going out there to a game if you played football and you're like, we're going to lose this game. Is the likelihood that you're going to win that game in your favor? No, it's like, we're going to win this game. You're believing it before you're even achieving it. There's a, you know, a real strong physical and psychological belief in that. And so I love, you know, going back to the psychology of belief and understanding, like you have to understand your psychology and who you are and how you operate in the world and, you know, change or create new ways of being so that you can have more success. And narcissism is an interesting one that I've never really honed in on before, then perhaps I might after, you know, reviewing and reading your book. Do you see an opportunity there, whether it be for me or anybody else listening to this podcast who can, you know, see how they can use this as leverage to dial it up or dial it down? And you may have touched on that a little bit.
Yeah, it's very interesting what you're talking about. It raises a couple of things. One is things, yeah, I hate that word. One of the structures you see with narcissism is this more what we call extrinsic motivational style. It's basically people are they're doing it for the fame, they're doing it for the credit, they're doing it for the cheers, they're doing it for the awards, they're doing it for something other than themselves. I mean, they're doing it for themselves, but it's to get attention from other people. Mm-hmm. And that's something you see with narcissism. The problem with working like that is it's an effective way to work. You build up your ego, you go out and get status, it feeds back into your ego, your ego gets bigger, you go out there and get more confidence, you get more status, and you can just sort of have it feed on itself. The problem with that more extrinsic way of running your life is it's exciting, but it's not very authentic. It lacks a lot of connection. It lacks a lot of humanity. So you're basically building a shell, or you're building a structure of a self, but you're not really connecting authentically with people, and you're not really connecting authentically with what, you know, you want, what you're, I mean, you're not really expressing anything authentic when you're doing this. You're just getting attention.
Yeah. It doesn't sound sustainable either. Right.
So right. So you burn out
and running it fast and you get burned out rather than, you know, running the marathon for the long haul, like it's the journey.
Yes. Like I used to say, it's like a shark. You just have to keep moving to keep it going. And it's just exhausting. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's, now people can do it, but when you see people who are narcissistic, who are really old, they have to do a lot of work to keep it up. I mean, that, well, you must see this. You must know this so much more than I do.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
But you imagine, you know, the amount of effort they have to put in to keep that kind of shell going. And if they could just let that go, what peace they'd have. But, you know, it's rewarding if you can do it.
No doubt. And on the opposite end of that, or, you know, if you're in a space where you're aspiring or wanting, you know, those things, right, if you will, you know, in a space like we live here in Los Angeles, I mean, really anywhere in the world, and especially now on social media, the world is flat. So you see it all the time and everybody's posting the best versions of themselves. And, yeah, you know, it's like, I want that. I need that. I have to have that. And like, when you can't get it, or it's not attainable, or it's out of your reach, whatever it is and how it looks, you know, you start to get insecure, and it's like, you're not happy with what you've got. And I'm a big believer and share all the time with clients, part of what I do is gratitude. That's one of the biggest areas of the psychology and belief system that I help people with, is just be grateful for what you have, right? Even if it's not where you want to be, that's okay, because where you are is a great place. We're just going to make it a little better and, you know, progress you through whatever it is you need to go.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, we talk about that in the book as one of the key antidotes, especially to that sense of entitlement. You know, we kind of get up and you're like, God, I should just have this more. And if I just had this, or if I had more attention, more and more and more, it never ends. Like, you'll never be the coolest person on earth. That just doesn't happen. And if you're chasing it all the time, you're going to be miserable. But what gratitude does is it turns that system off. So instead of thinking about what you need to fill up, you're thinking what you can put out there. So I think that's 100%. It turns that off, and you can be much more successful than you're not. Anyway, it's painful.
Yeah, and success is defined in so many different ways, right? You know, in the narcissist's mind's eye, what usually is the quantifiable nature of success in your experience?
I mean, the simple formula is sex, status, and stuff. I mean, if you look in, you know, relationships, it's a lot of short-term relationships, it's trophy partners. If you look in interpersonal relationships, it's leadership roles or social status or fame. So narcissism is associated with fame. I mean, Drew Pinsky did a study of celebrities and found high scores. Not every celebrity, of course, is, you know, a narcissist, but just if you're going to have higher narcissism in those areas. And then stuff, you know, materialism, but it's not, it's a certain kind. It's products that show your status to people. So cars that connote status, watches, clothes, you know, doing your outfits in a way, all those things. So you can detect narcissism in people because they put more effort into their appearance because they want to look better.
Mm. I mean, interesting.
And there's nothing wrong with that. And the problem in your business in Hollywood is that's part of your freaking job. So you could be St. Peter and you'd have to get your teeth done and your hair done and everything else, or else you're not getting hired. So it kind of morphs, you know, you don't really judge celebrities because that's kind of their job, you know?
Right. Well, this is also the challenge in the world today. Again, going back to what I said, the world is flat and we can see and see everybody's best version of themselves around the world and in ways that we were never exposed to before. And, you know, you see this and you want that and you're doing all these things within your, you know, financial budgets, within your reasons, means to do physical changes and people adding stuff to their bodies or removing things from their bodies and injecting things and flattening things and smoothing things and, you know, doing exercises. Again, this is a health and fitness show as well. But, you know, I see only sexy exercises is what I like to call them on Instagram, where people are showing the coolest, latest, like, way to work this body part or this movement. Yeah. And you're like, when and why do I ever need to do that? And that's where I draw the line. And what I do, I'm a functional fitness expert, guru, if you will. And I love to train people in a way that makes them move and function better in their lives, not to look better, but to move and function better, whatever and however that looks, whether you're a professional athlete or you're, you know, grandma that needs to go grocery shopping and lift the 30-pound bag of groceries out of your cart and put it into your back of your car, you know. But today with Instagram, you're seeing all this sexy stuff and you're like, God, this is just not cool. And people think that that's what you need to have a fit body and a healthy mind and whatever else. How do we stop this, like, out of control running train?
I mean, first of all, that's really interesting. I hadn't thought about it in the fitness world, and I'm not a, I'm a yogi. I mean, that's what I do. So I do
some yoga too.
Yeah, I was going to say I do some Bikram in front of the mirror, so I know what you're talking about. Because I before the shutdown, I used to love doing yoga with the influencers. They, I mean, that's what I called them. They were so so good looking. During the, and so I understand it, and I understand how, the way the algorithms would work, the people getting, you know, judged as attractive are going to be doing something that's more attractive than the average person or more extreme than the average person. In the case of yoga, if I'm putting out my yoga pose and it's like how to do a basic chaturanga versus how to do an upside down, you know, Ashtanga crisscrossana or whatever, people are going to do the cool pose. And right. So then I want to go into yoga and I'm too intimidated to do it because I go, well, how, I'm supposed to balance on, you know, I'm supposed to be balancing on two hands like this. It's going to take me 10 years to do that. So I get it. It pushes people out of fitness because, and it makes it competitive. And what we've seen in general with social media, especially with young girls, is it's made them very depressed. And very anxious.
Studies on this. There's a huge depression rate going up in the youth today that has been unlike any other time in recorded history.
Yeah, and that is, I mean, there's like, we can't nail it down, and I've only done a little work in this area. My friend Gene Twenge does a lot, but it looks like social media is a big part of it, and part of it is that social comparison. I mean, imagine if I were on social media watching yogis all the time. I feel pretty good about myself. Mm-hmm. But if I were on time watching, because we joke, no offense to you guys, but we joke about it as like Hollywood yoga or LA yoga. Yeah. And I mean, last time I went out and did a class, I apologize for sharing, but I was in there and I'm like, these people have to work for Cirque du Soleil. I mean, they have to, because they are so damn attractive. And I went up and did a downward dog. My entire sinus cavity released because I'd been body surfing down at Salt Creek with a bunch of 14-year-olds and shoved about a quart of water. It was just so damn embarrassing. So I get it, man. I don't know. I mean, so I can see how that's really destructive to the industry because it puts up this really competitive kind of barrier to entry for people.
Yeah, and an expectation that is just not necessary. And that's, you know, I like to say, you know, they call it like a purist, you know, someone who, like, you know, I work within the science, like I'm sure yourself, you know, in the area of psychology and, you know, having the education that you do, there's people that are crossing boundaries that necessarily don't need to be crossed. You know, basics are fundamental. And when you get the basics and the foundation, just in my experience, and I may be totally wrong, is that you can get more out of it by just having the strong foundation and working that foundation than going to the top, where that top may be just for a small percentage of people, but it's not for everybody.
Oh, I mean, this is outside of my psychology world, but the way I kind of run my life is with the koshas. I'm like, you got to get the diet right to get the body right. If the body's right, you got to have the breath right. And the breath right, you got to have the feeling right. And the feeling's right, you got to get the mind right. If the mind's right, your spirit might be right. But if you don't have all those things working, it's going to be a miserable SOB. I mean, still suffering, you know?
Right.
So I really look at it as foundation work. You know, if you're not working from, but that's outside of my, that's just personal. No,
it may perhaps be outside of the scope of your studies, but it is within your studies because it is mind body connection. It is like, I mean, you're first, you not only have studied the mind of, you know, human psychology, but you're actually, you know, now learning your a yogi and you practice it and been practicing it for many years. And so you have an understanding that is well adapted to be able to guide us and, you know, offer us some insight, no doubt. So I would not think about discrediting your, you know, value or contribution to the conversation in and around that space. So please, you know,
don't
don't refrain from offering any, you know, sound advice that you think that comes to your mind, because it's an open table of conversation. And I understand where you're coming from, because probably from where you come from, everything has to be validated and peer reviewed before you put it out there. It's what I love and don't love about what I do is that it doesn't necessarily always have to be. And that's where that purist comes from, because I like sound human movement science, right? Where the joints do, you know, this plane of motion and they accelerate in this one, they decelerate in that one, and not looking like you're, you know, in circuits delay. So
yeah,
again, that's that 1%. So no, all good conversation. I love this. As you can tell, really just having a field day with this. So how did you get into this area of science and study of narcissism? Did you have a bout with it that turned you onto it?
No, it wasn't like, you know, kind of a classic research, me search thing. A couple reasons. One, just there's this, I mean, just let's say like the self, just how we all see the world through a big distortion field. Once reality hits our ego, it just gets distorted.
Yeah.
You know, when it's about someone else, you judge it one way. When it's about you, you judge it another way. I mean, and you see this in all walks of life. You know, somebody gets car gets an accident. You're like, oh well, your car gets an accident. Oh my God, it's the biggest thing ever. You know, somebody tells you you're not attractive. You're like, that's just terrible. If you're narcissistic, you're like, how dare you? If you're depressed, you go, oh, I feel so insecure. So we're always kind of hearing stuff and distorting stuff. And narcissism is an interesting way to look at it, because people who are narcissistic really distort their ego in a certain way. It's just kind of an easy way to see it, but everyone does this. It's not like if you're not narcissistic, you're just kind of got the world nailed. It's just you're kind of dealing with a different kind of reality. And the other thing for me was I was really interested in Buddhism and Taoism and what the non-self would be in non-attachment. And I couldn't figure out how to study that at all. Mm. And so I kind of went the opposite way. I'm like, well, let's just study the biggest ego we can. And then it just, you know, narcissism is one of those topics where, you know, I started studying it and then the school shootings happened. Mm-hmm. And it's like, oh my God, this is attention-seeking violence. These acts of terrorism are essentially attention-seeking. This is narcissism. And then social media started happening. And this is 10, 15 years. I'm like, oh my God, this is, you know, look, these people are narcissistic, are the ones really building these networks because they're attention-seeking and they want more connections. They have more friends. And then it became selfies, you know, all of a sudden we all had these devices to take pictures of ourselves and share each other. I mean, this is crazy when this happened. You know, before that you had to have a camera and run away and get, you know, and then everyone starts talking about, and you know, and lo and behold, people are narcissistic, take more selfies, they share more, show more body image. So, and then with leadership and Trump, and believe me, I don't want to talk about politics, but once again, people like, look at narcissism, look at leadership, what's going on with the world? All these leaders are self-centered. And so narcissism, unfortunately, is the gift that's kept on giving as sort of a research question.
Mm. So it's kept you in business, but it's killing the world.
Yes, exactly. It's like, you just want to be wrong. I want to be out of business. I went like, no one's interested in that, man. It's just wrong. It's awful.
It is. So would you consider the possibility that narcissism could also be in the space of somebody who is a Buddhist or in, you know, yoga or the world of detachment and all that as well, because I see you nodding your head and like I see some like a very heartfelt you know kind of emotion running through you right now.
I mean the you know, speaking of yoga, probably the easiest way to see it is watch that movie on Vikram, you know, on Netflix, because he's just classic. And I apologize, I laugh at everything, but when he was sitting in his throne on a Mauna Kea beach, as I remember, Mauna Kea beach resort town. You might know Mauna Kea beach being out in West Hollywood, but sort of the old Rockefeller resort in Hawaii with his own air conditioner.
Yeah.
I'm like, that is the greatest moment of narcissism. I mean, it's just unbelievable. Telling everyone what to do.
Yeah.
I did Bikram yoga today. I mean, as much as I think the guy's kind of full of himself, I still did his practice. They renamed it now. They call it something else, 26 and 2.
Is that what it's called, 26 and 2?
Yeah, sometimes people call it that, or they'll ghost practice.
About that, because I mean, that was a really horrific look at somebody who took, you know, actually who created a movement that was extraordinary and changed so many people's lives, and had so, if he had just stayed on the right path and didn't go into that, he could have really really created a legacy for himself that would have been, you know, gone down into the history books for thousands of years. Now it's all gone.
You know, that's it. That's the problem with narcissists. Well, it's one problem. It's short-term gain, long-term loss of reputation, loss of respect. But, you know, the thing with the spiritual world, or the world of gurus, is there's no way to test. Mm-hmm. So to get a PhD, you know, I have a committee of three people. I say, grant me a PhD. I have to take a certain amount of courses to be a certain institution. To be a guru in an Indian tradition, you have to have an actual guru who's been, you know, kind of anointed by another guru, you know, anoint you. So there's a lineage. If you go in like the plant medicine tradition, you know, you have a teacher and they teach each other. So there's all these traditions have a mechanism to get rid of riffraff. Mm-hmm. But in the US, with sort of the spiritual community that's unregulated, It's a wide open field for people who are charlatans, because there's no real way to stop it. But the people who are really successful, the people who have a good message, who are just really good self-promoters, because they love the attention. And so they end up selling the product. It might be a good product. They get the attention from it. And then occasionally they just slip up. They go, well, nothing's real. The whole world's an illusion. So I can sleep with my students, you know, or I've really transcended myself. I don't really have an ego, so I'm not really attached to this. So I can sleep with my students. I mean, you can just imagine that the rational, you know, you start thinking you're enlightened and stop watching yourself. It would be very easy to slip into this stuff. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, being a guru is a high risk occupation for narcissism. Mm-hmm.
You had mentioned plant medicine, and it's interesting you bring that up, because I wanted to bring that up. I thought about it earlier in the conversation. The use of plant medicine is becoming a lot more popularized, you know, outside of the use of marijuana, which is now legal in most, you know, 50 states across the U.S. We're talking about hallucinogenic mushrooms, aka the magic mushroom, as well as ayahuasca, which is a Peruvian plant that, you know, combined with something else, has these hallucinogenic trips of, you know, that you supposedly purge yourself of an old being, a way of being that doesn't serve you anymore, to as well like DMT, where there's, you know, I've dabbled in some of it. I will say that I've done all of it except the ayahuasca. And I just reached out to the gentleman on the, who has a Netflix show that's, it's called, well, it's the show called Unwell. And it's a documentary on there called Unwell. And there's six different type of homeopathic different ways of, like, people are promoting health and wellness. And they're actually kind of contradicting it, saying it may not be really what it's cracked up to be. And ayahuasca was one. I reached out to the guy, and he's got a religious center, which is what he hides under, that title in Florida, to be able to practice these ayahuasca, retreats. And I reached out and he invited me to go do it. And I've had several people in my life that I know very well, some very close to me, done it and have encouraged me to do it. And I've been honestly scared. I've done the
other. You should be.
I should or shouldn't be?
You should be.
I should be, yeah.
Why wouldn't you be scared?
Yeah, I because I've had other people like rave about it and I've done it many times and they're like, I'm, you know, better for doing it. And I'm always on this search and journey for doing better and more and wanting more and trying to transcend my, you know, way of being so that I can serve others better. But I, you know, am curious to know, I mean, this isn't about me not bringing this up, but it's about like, how is the use of these plant medicines today in the world of psychology, or if we're talking about narcissism, how is it used in that space, if it is at all?
Yeah. So, I mean, I find this stuff absolutely fascinating. I have a graduate student, Brandon Weiss, who did his dissertation on ayahuasca ceremonies down in Peru and Costa Rica. And so it's very, very interesting. So in terms of psychology overall, we're seeing these, I mean, we're seeing effects of mushrooms, smoke DMT, ayahuasca from our work and from others. All of them seem to show some improvements in things like depression or neuroticism. What we found is trait neuroticism, what other people found of symptoms of depression, but they're all kind of the same constellation of traits. It's this arousal, hostility, anxiety, depression. So that area seems to improve substantially. I mean, this is not FDA trials. This isn't bro science either. I mean, this is like pretty good data, but it's not clinical. But it, to me, I'm like, this stuff seems like it's doing something. Mm-hmm. We work with a group called Heroic Hearts, which takes special forces or special operations troops who have PTSD down to Peru to work with ayahuasca. And they've had a lot of success with PTSD. So there's a lot of groups doing this for those areas. In terms of narcissism, there's been one study they published found that the experience of awe, so this sort of, you know, tremendous, and if you've, you know, done this, like you've seen this sort of this sense of awe, that can be sort of ego reducing to people. So there's a potential to reduce some narcissism with it, I think. But when we've looked at it, it's not really clear. I think maybe what's going on is it might increase extroversion in people. Like it might make people more energized and more vital, which is, might look like narcissism if you're somebody really shy to start with. Like if you're somebody really depressed and you end up becoming more engaged, it might look like you're becoming more narcissistic. Mm-hmm. So I think what's really interesting is that sense of awe. And then, you know, the discussion is ego death and what the heck is ego death and what does that have to do with narcissism? And that's kind of like those questions you're asking. It's how can someone have this spiritual self, but still this really engaged other self? And so it's a very interesting set of questions. And the research is exploding right now. It's so interesting.
And is it exploding because it's, again, the world has become more flat and we're exposed to this more, where it's been used in the past where, you know, like in Peru, I mean, ayahuasca has been used in ceremonies for, you know, thousands of years among the indigenous tribes there. Now it's becoming popularized because people saw perhaps one person use it on some kind of social media platform and then it just.
Yeah. Expanded. So I think a few different things happened. One is people that use plant medicines for the entire history of humanity. Bill W., who founded AA, wanted to use LSD to help treat alcoholism. Mm-hmm. They just shut it all down. The problem is not the medicines. The problem is that, you know, Nixon just made it all illegal for no reason that anyone can tell other than throw hippies in jail. I mean, for real. I mean, they just shut it all down. And so that's why it's coming. And it started to break through. You know, a few things got legal, a few trials got through. Now we're at stage three trials with MDMA. And people started getting really excited about it when they started seeing these early effects. But it's been just cooking for a few years, and now it's just on fire. And what scares me personally is, one, is somebody who, I mean, I really like the plant medicine tradition. I have a friend who's a shaman who kind of like, because I started studying, I'm like, dude, can you kind of show me how this works a little bit? And And so this is powerful, important stuff. And I like to keep it sacred. Mm-hmm. And my concern is there's a lot of, you know, tourism down there that people are kind of not really engaged, and it's selfie based, but, and a lot of shaman who aren't really trained, that aren't really, you know, haven't really trained in the appropriate lineage. And that's always a risk with stuff like this. Just a risk. That's what it explodes.
Sure. It gets diluted, you know, and it's because it's more than just the plant medicine. It's the rituals. Like my wife is Japanese, and you know, there are, we went to Japan last year around this time. We went to Kyoto, and there's a, you know, a very strong tradition in the Japanese tea ceremony space mm-hmm. in Japan. And we did her mom was a Japanese tea ceremony instructor or teacher, if you will. And she would teach others to do that. We went through this Japanese tea ceremony that took 30 plus minutes in the preparation and in the process. And you get this little cup of tea that takes, you know, three sips to finish. Yeah. And you're like, wow, that was a lot of work for this little thing, but it was more about the ritual doing it that makes it more important, or as important as just drinking the tea. So I understand what you're saying about, you know, the diluting of the lineage and the heritage of it. What is the, so you want to go back and you say that, you know, you should be afraid or fearful of doing that. Why?
Well, okay. So here's the thing. I'm a psychologist. I understand psychology. Our models, if you go to Imperial College and Google what their models are, that these substances, you know, have some neurochemical processes. They're opening up different sort of dreamlike states, and that allows you to reinterpret memories and restructure yourself. And so they look at it as a very neurological and biological process. Shamanic community look at it as psycho-spiritual, meaning they legit think that the plant medicine itself, so that ayahuasca has a spirit that's, you know, the mama, they call her, Ronin and Shipibo. And that spirit is a lot like Shiva in India, which is the Lord of Yoga. It's not a gentle, I mean, no one ever said, yeah, I'm buddies with ayahuasca. I mean, it's never been gentle with anyone. You know, it's very direct. It's kind of like a very stern, loving grandmother. I mean, that's how it's experienced in this tradition, the Shipibo. It can be male in other traditions, but that's, so one thing is it has those energies. The other thing is when you start messing with these medicines and you're opening up the possibility of these other energies to get into, what you described about the bodies is how I've been taught, which is they look at these sort of either these ghosts or dead energies or unhelpful energies or even external energies that are kind of clinging to your soul, and they're trying to clean those off. And that's how they see it in some ways. If you start opening those channels without somebody who's a good person doing it, it's just kind of dangerous. The same way it would be dangerous if you said, hey, Keith, I heard psychoanalysis is really important, and I'm going to go do psychoanalysis with this guy I met in New York. There's a bunch of them. It's really popular now. And I'm just going to talk about my feelings, and we'll just share, and I'm going to stay on this couch for four times a week for 6 months. I'm like, that's really dangerous if somebody's not trained. So people who were trained in traditional psychoanalysis, the Freudians, they had to be psychoanalyzed themselves twice, because they didn't want people getting in people's minds who are psychopaths. Right. You know, in clinical psychology now, I shouldn't say I'm not a clinical psychologist, but our program, it's very, very careful in who they take in. You don't want people in this business who are dangerous psychopathic people. So,
so you're saying the fear base or the precaution you should take is where it's coming from, the source,
exactly,
rather than the plant itself. And you should obviously, like anything else, do in moderation and make sure that, you know, things are legit.
Yes. I think that we've worked with these centers in Peru and Costa Rica, like Soltero is one you hear about, Arcana. They're very legitimate. They're open to science. I'm like, I trust those guys. I'd go down there. I worry about just going down and meeting somebody you don't know who it is. That's mm-hmm. what makes me, that's what makes me nervous. The other thing though with ayahuasca is when we look at those ceremonies, and my student who looked at them, they're very difficult for people. Often mm-hmm. people have these, they deal with these internal challenges and struggles that are very painful. Mm-hmm. And sometimes the extent to which it's very painful is the extent to which it's healing. You know what I mean? So it's, mm-hmm. it's a weird kind of medicine. It's not like you see, look, I'm no expert. I mean, but it's not that the mystical experience is the only mechanism of change. It also seems, at least in our data, that people experience the struggle of dealing with these internal, you know, just internal struggles, internal pain, internal suffering. And that is can be a very painful and challenging process of healing. Mm-hmm. So that's what I mean. There's no reason you wouldn't be scared of that. Hell, if I went with you, I'd be scared of that.
Yeah,
you know, because it's just, you know what I mean? That's because it's like going into psychotherapy and somebody going, look, I'm just going to tell you who you are straight up.
Yeah,
no bullshit. Sure. I mean, mm-hmm. God, I mean, be terrified, you know?
Yep.
So that maybe, or does that answer your question?
It. Yeah, it does. Or excited about it, right? If you're in that.
Oh, absolutely. Excited too.
And I think that's what, you know, a couple of these people that were encouraging me to do it, or at least exposing me to the possibility, said, you know, when you're ready, the shaman will show up, or the yeah. opportunity will show up for you, you know, so to speak. And perhaps you maybe I'll never be ready, right? Who knows? So that's an interesting way of looking at it. You know, kind of reverting here, going back to like marijuana being legalized, and again, almost all the states and now becoming just a recreational drug. I find that people self-medicate with marijuana more than they did use it for recreational purposes, like having a couple beers, you know. Now it's like people are self-medicating and numbing themselves out from the feelings that maybe narcissism has brought up, or, you know, is there. They're trying to suppress it because maybe they're not happy with it, or it's not, like you said, serving them well. And I find that if any drug that they should be concerned about is alcohol and marijuana, two that are very legal now. Would you agree with that, or am I off base?
Well, I like to stick to the research on this stuff. And I know, you know, there's this idea that marijuana use has gone up. There's the idea, is it substituting for something? So are people doing this to cope? And is it substituting for just coping? Or is it substituting for taking, you know, Xanax or benzos? Or is it substituting for alcohol? Or is it substituting for opiates? Mm-hmm. And if people are, you know, using cannabis instead of any of those things,
that's better.
That seems better.
Yeah.
But if it's substituting for like actually engaging in life, then it's going to be something that's detrimental. So that's a classic problem with self-regulation. You know, you want to get from point A to point B, but there's always suffering in between. There's emotional suffering. And the easiest way to shut off emotional suffering is a drug or eat sugar, or, you know, you get rid of that emotion, and that's how you mm-hmm. self-regulate. You're like, God, I should have worked out. Ah, damn it. I feel so bad. I'll have a glass of wine and a donut. Yeah. You'll feel good. So you regulate the emotion instead of regulating the underlying problem. So you feel good in the short term, but over time, you just feel worse and worse and worse.
Yeah,
so you want to avoid those traps.
It's interesting you brought up sugar, because I talk about a lot. I had somebody on the show who has a business called sugaraddiction.com. And that is the worst drug I think we're putting in our body. Not I think, I know we're putting in our body, that's legalized and is almost in everything that you can find on the counter.
I, you know, like I said, off my area, but when I figured out this and I went cold turkey off carbs and sugar, it was like the withdrawal I couldn't imagine. I remember thinking if I saw a Girl Scout, I would just beat her and steal those cookies and eat them. I wanted them so bad. I mean, it's awful. It was like a terrible, like it was a terrible craving. And once it took a couple of weeks to kick it, but I was addicted to it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
now, what role does that play? I mean, you say, again, going back, you're saying that it's outside of your scope of study, but I imagine that it is, because many people that perhaps you see or study or have, you know, witnessed or read research on, that might be an underlying cause of a lot of the challenges that people are facing psychological that
if
not even addressing at this point, maybe they are now.
Yeah. Well, look, if you want to ask me what people, the entire diet of the country is has everyone running on this kind of super fast, you know, kind of insulin spikes all the time. And so they're kind of chronically what the psychologists call hungry, angry, lonely, tired, you know, those kind of triggers. So yeah. People are constantly kind of hangry, you know, because they always need the sugar fix. You get a lot of hanger and a lot of frustration. It's hard to center. And then you get type 2 diabetes being the real problem that come out of it. And so then you get people that are unfit. They're at high risk for something like COVID, you know, because the COVID risk is higher with type 2 diabetes. And so their whole life gets deregulated. I think sugar is very dangerous.
Mm-hmm. And as a psychologist, I'm assuming you're a psychologist.
Okay. Personality, social personality psychologist.
Okay. Yeah. Somebody who's dealing with that, again, our many listeners, and listen, whether you're in the health and fitness space or you're not, or you're just trying to get to be better in life, and you look at sugar and what it is, like what foods you're eating that have sugar, how would you recommend managing that from that perspective of your background?
Well, I mean, there's different approaches. So there's sort of the more self-awareness approach, which is asking people to take food diaries, or, you know, and there's a lot of apps for this now that you can, you know, talking about apps, you can take pictures of eating, just understand what you're doing. Cause some people are just out of control snacking. I used to do this. I mean, some people, Steve, I've never met any of them except for me when I used to just pop Swedish fish, you know, every 15 minutes through the day. I mean, so sometimes there's that, you're not really aware of what you're doing. And then sometimes you're aware, and then it becomes a question of quitting. And that's a challenge. I think there's different approaches. I'm not an expert, but there's the classic, you know, cold turkey talking to a doctor, but the classic cold turkey and suck it up. And then there's the, you know, step it down substitution approach.
Right.
My guess is that different people work differently. I just cut stuff out because I'm kind of extreme and I'm not very good at temperance. But some people I know are very temperate and they're like, yeah, I just weigh my food, I just cut it down. I'm like, great, that works for you too. But whatever it is, you know, you know, and the other thing I tell people is or might suggest is don't change your life forever. Just try it for a month. Try things for a couple of months and see what happens. Yeah, give it 6 weeks, you know,
and then you'll perhaps you'll feel better. And then that motivation and how you feel will help to create more motivation. And
if it doesn't work, it doesn't work. And it was a dumb idea, but just instead of arguing, because people in the diet world and the psychology world, people can argue forever. I'm like, dude, just try it. Just try it. It's not that hard. If it doesn't work, then try something else. You know, so a lot of times that just willingness to try rather than get it perfect.
Definitely. I think that's huge. Try it, do it. Don't think about perfection. And you're going to, I say zig and zag. You want to zig more than you zag. And, you know, I have a rule of thumb that I like to impart on my clients and people that listen to podcasts. This is the 80-20 rule. You know, 80% of the time you should be doing things really well. 20% of the time you can give yourself some slack, you know, because your body is resilient. It's an amazing machine and mechanism for it to rebound and reboot. And then perhaps you get so clean sometimes, like myself, where I have a little bit of something and I feel the effects. Like I get sometimes food hangovers, right? So if I go out to dinner and they're known for great desserts and I'm like, oh, I got a sweet tooth. Sure, I'll have some of that. And I wake up and I'm like, I feel like I just drank 2 glasses of wine or 3 glasses of wine and I didn't have any alcohol. And it's just the sugar that I had. It's crazy.
Yeah, well, I mean, life is what they used to call compromise formations. We can't get everything we want all the time. So you got to figure out how to regulate it. But for me, like diet and exercise are foundational. I mean, when people, you know, and before psychology, you know, if you get your diet and exercise right and you've got depression, then you've got something you got to deal with. You know, it's coming from your mind or you've got to get it's meds or something. But with the diet and exercise off, it can lead to all sorts of dysregulation, you know, depression, anxiety, suffering, it's just anger. So I think it's really important.
So this will be kind of a sort of in closing conversation, but I think it's really important today. in the space of COVID, where we're now having to really isolate ourselves in so many ways. And they're also talking about the increased rate of depression and other types of anxieties in and around this now new space that we're navigating in. What would be some of your suggestions on helping somebody manage some of these anxieties and depressions? One, you mentioned exercise, which I love that you mentioned that as being probably at the forefront of some of the ways in which you can manage this. I mean, now you could do home workouts. And by the way, I've got a great home workout program on Zoom. It's called on.zoom.us. It's called Core Sculpt. So check it out. It's on Tuesday, Thursday, Saturdays at noon. That's the first time I'm plugging that. So thanks for giving me the space to do that. But again, it's on.zoom.us and it's called Core Sculpt. So what would you recommend others to do to be able
to? Definitely plug away, because you got to keep fit. You know, I mean, during the COVID, I was just doing yoga outside, and that was trying to get sun and doing some exercise. The challenge, I think, is sleep. People can sleep. That seems to be helping. And a lot of the high school kids seem to be doing okay because they're sleeping. But the other thing is social life. And what's being challenged is people aren't having social life, or they're having too much social life. They can't separate from people. So families are just right on top of each other, and they're getting, you know, it's like cabin fever. Or people are becoming really isolated and cut off. And I think it's really, really important for mental health to have social connections. So if you're like feeling bad, just reach out to somebody. I mean, number one, and if it can be visual, you know, do a Zoom call with a friend, or set up a group, or, you know, go sit in the yard and have cocktails, or do something. But that social life is super important. And then, you know, we're in this media world that's just insane. It's insane. I'm very smart. It's insane for me. It's got to be insane for everybody. So turn it off a while and unplug for a certain amount of time each day. You know, realize that there's a real world and a media world, and you can kind of separate them. But that's hard to do, because it's just force fed to us.
And it's right at our fingertips. Yeah. Oh, so that great advice. So exercise, eat well, sleep. Get the adequate amount of sleep, turn off your devices, and disconnect from that. All great advice for you.
And connect with others.
And connect with others. I forgot about the socializing for sure. But just do it obviously in a safe and well-adjusted manner. So let me ask you one final question. If you were to just write a very, you know, short cliff note version of your book, and what you would want someone to, what the expectations that someone should have after reading your book, The New Science of Narcissism, what would you want that to sound like?
Cliff Notes version is that I'm unfortunately an academic, so I hope somebody who reads this book we'll figure out what narcissism is, but also kind of understand how personality works a little bit. They'll be able to apply it in kind of relationships, social media, leadership. I just kind of wrote chapters on each of those core issues. Understand the clinical world of narcissism and narcissistic personality a bit, what we know and what we don't know, and kind of understand where some of the science is going if they're a bit of a nerd. So it's got a little bit. I really try to put anything in there for people who are interested in narcissism to find.
Awesome. That's a great synopsis there. And I think it's really important for us all to understand ourselves better so that we can self-regulate and manage our lives from the inside out, as this podcast really demonstrates and helps to try and to cast a shadow or cast a light onto, you know, for you to be better and have a life of abundance of health and fitness. So it's been awesome to have you on, Keith.
It was fun. Thank you.
Connect with you in so many ways. I can have this conversation for probably another hour with you and keep going down this rabbit hole and digging some more things out about narcissism, our psychology, and our belief systems, and why it's working for us or not working for us. And I'm excited to read your book, The New Science of Narcissism. Everybody, check it out on Amazon. Understand It's called The Understanding One's Greatness, Psychological Challenges of Our Times, and What You Can Get and Do About It. So I think it's more important today than ever. And Keith, I acknowledge you for all that you do and your work. And I don't, I would like to just tell you, don't apologize for being the science nerd that you are, because we need people like you to put it out there and to you know, create these robust education platforms and have that peer-reviewed published science so that there is a standard, right, that we can live by and work with.
Yeah, well, thank you so much for having me. And no one out there be afraid of getting on Google Scholar and just looking up science. It's not scary. You can find it.
Awesome. Great stuff. Well, listen, everybody, I appreciate your listening. I appreciate your time. Keith, again, appreciate you for being on the show and sharing your wisdom. And until next time, everybody, please stay healthy and fit.
For more information or support on how you can be healthy and fit, visit my website at stevejordan.com or follow me on Instagram at stevejordanlifestyle. Subscribe to I Am Healthy and Fit wherever you are listening so you don't miss any future episodes that could better your health and fitness. One last favor, friends, please rate this podcast on Apple Podcasts. Your rating and comments not only help my podcast reach more people, but you could literally be saving someone's life who found it because of your feedback. Thanks again for listening, and stay healthy and fit.